Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crimes to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and would like the CrimeWire team to send them information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. I'm Donna Pendergast, filling in tonight for Susan. Denny, why don't we get started by having you introduce our first case tonight?
Okay, thanks a lot, Donna. Just a quick word before we get into tonight's case. I wanted to update people on the death penalty poll we had posted on the website. And the number one response that received 53% was that the costs related to the death penalty are primarily caused by the endless appeals. The process needs to be streamlined and sentences carried out in a timely manner. So that was the top vote getter in the death penalty poll. And I also want to welcome in our listening audience and also to the CrimeWire site a lot of the friends and supporters of Morgan Harrington's family. Several of them are now participating on the CrimeWire site and posting on the threads there in the forums, and I believe several of them are also listening to the show tonight. On September 4th, 2008, 33-year-old Daniel Ray Underwood, his girlfriend Rebecca Nelson, and a friend, Maria Harvick, were at a bar in East Fork, Texas. The three then went back to the home Daniel and Rebecca shared in Sulphur Springs, Texas. According to Maria, once there, Daniel and Rebecca got into an argument, and Maria left the room. A short time later, she went into the hallway where Daniel and Rebecca were continuing their disagreement and saw Daniel holding a shotgun in his right hand and accusing Rebecca of taking all his money and burying him in debt. Rebecca grabbed the gun and a struggle ensued. Maria again walked away, and seconds later, she heard the shotgun go off. She stepped back into the hallway and saw Daniel fall to the floor, mortally wounded. Was Daniel's death an accident, a suicide, or neither? The authorities went with suicide. And tonight, joining us to discuss this case is Daniel Underwood's mom, Donna Underwood, and CrimeWire statement analyst and CrimeWire consultant, Peter Hyatt. Donna and Peter, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you, Danny. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to be here as well, Dan. Thank you.
Okay, Donna, let's start off. Could you tell us, you didn't agree with the suicide decision by the authorities. Am I correct?
That's correct. I did not.
And was that an immediate reaction, or how long did it take you to start questioning that ruling?
No, it wasn't immediate, because after we got the call, you know, we were just in shock. And we went to the hospital, and Rebecca come up there, and I asked her, you know, what happened. And she started giving me this thing about Daniel had got online and looked at their checkbook or statement, and that he was saying, you know, what were they going to do? And they still had money in there. And she said, well, I'll get another job. And she said, then Daniel had jumped up, and he said, I'll show you what I'm going to do. And he'd got the gun. And she went in there and started grabbing for it. Well, I still didn't think nothing about it. But then she started telling me that she grabbed for the gun, got his right hand, and was holding it. And then the gun moved off, and it went off. Or it moved from under his chin, and it went off. And from that point on, you know, it just didn't make sense to me. But I still didn't think, you know, I just couldn't concentrate until I called her earlier in the day and asked her if we could meet with her to get Daniel's truck and his cell phone back, and then we'd get with her after the funeral. And when I called her that, and it had been like a few hours, she started cussing me out from one end to the other, saying that she was his beneficiary. She owned everything he had, and, you know, she wasn't going to give us anything back, which, you know, I was just doing what I thought I needed to do, you know, until we could get things situated.
And Rebecca was interviewed by the police after the shooting, is that correct?
Yes.
And, in fact, those interviews she had with the police were videotaped?
Yes, they are.
And have you watched the tapes of her interviews?
Yes.
Was there or is there anything in the interviews that caught your attention?
The very beginning, the first words out of her mouth was, could she get Daniel's wallet and his credit cards that was in his name? And that right there, you know, just I stopped right there. And then from that point on, it just got worse and worse. She acknowledges that there was missing money, which is what Maria said that Daniel was confronting her about and questioning her about the missing money. But she was saying that Daniel said that the ring she had from his ex-wife wasn't big enough because it was only 5 carats. And, you know, she was just admiring the ring in the video like it was, you know, instead of crying and all this. And nothing sounded right.
Hey, Donna, can I ask you, said instead of crying, when you first came in contact with Rebecca, can you tell our listeners what was her demeanor like? You know, did she appear upset? Was she calm? I mean, how did she seem?
When she called, she just said she started out calling me Mom, which she never did because I didn't even hardly know her. And she said Daniel had shot herself, and, you know, she was acting kind of frantic. But, you know, and I asked her where they was at and was he okay, and then we headed up there. And then when she started talking to me and she was telling me about it and she was right in my face and she would act like she was squinting her eyes up, but I never seen a tear come out. And she had her bloody hands in my face telling me that she put my son's brains back and was holding it and stuff like that, you know, right there. It was just horrible.
Well, Rebecca is the one that also told her friend Maria, who was at the scene, but I mean, she didn't witness the actual shooting. I think she stepped away for a second. But Rebecca told her not to tell the police that she and Daniel had been arguing. So you got that situation number one going on, right, Donna?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and then in her second interview, taped interview, she makes mention that she did work for law enforcement. Now, unless she's a typist or works in the records room or something like that, the only other thing she could be doing is working as a confidential informant, okay? I've had numerous ones of them when I was working narcotics and things of that nature. So that kind of changes her relationship with the police, you know, where they maybe have a tendency to believe her when she says, well, yeah, he put his face down, he killed himself, and that's the end of the whole thing. Right, Donna?
Yes, it is. And she kept referring to the detective as her good friend, Bo, and she'd make little parentheses with her fingers as she did it each time. And I still, you know, was just clueless about what she was talking about. But on the tapes, she does say that she's given tips, and he says something about this in the other cases that you've worked with us on.
And our listeners need to understand too that Daniel had made Rebecca the beneficiary on his life insurance policy a few weeks before he was shot. Number one. Number two, Rebecca told her friends a week or so before the shooting she was tired of Daniel, wanted to break up with him. She was going to take him for everything he had and then leave and get back with one of her old boyfriends. So you have a whole bunch of things here that she said or did on this case.
Well, she said Daniel made her the beneficiary, but nothing was ever he had quit his job, so he didn't have any life insurance except he had some on his kids. So she was just saying all that. She thought she was his beneficiary. She thought she owned his house and his vehicles and everything, which he owed on everything. You know, it wasn't like she was getting anything.
But she thought she was.
Anna, how long were Daniel and Rebecca together for?
He had met her the end of June, and she had moved into his house July 4th weekend.
So only some 2 months before this incident actually occurred.
Yes, and she was still married, and when she was saying they were engaged, we had never heard that until that day.
Are you saying that Rebecca was still married when she moved in?
Yes, she was still married, and I don't know if she's gotten a divorce since then. It's been 2 years. But she was still married then, and my son had only gotten his divorce August the 25th, and this happened September the 4th.
Peter? Peter?
Yes.
Yeah, did you have an opportunity to take a look at those videotaped interviews Rebecca did?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I was able to analyze three of the tapes so far, and they do test for deception. She is being deceptive on several areas, several key areas. She's contradictory. And then I would have to say, and I imagine Vito would be able to comment on this more, but the police interview was broke just about every rule of interviewing there. Very poorly conducted. When he came back into the room after hearing the rumor that that was out in the town that they were involved together, he was completely off his game. He interrupted her. He introduced new language to her. She was handled with kid gloves. But right from the first opening moments, as she begins, she said they never argued, and he wasn't depressed, no mental health issues ever. And when he asked initially, had you been arguing, had you been fighting, when someone answers never, never doesn't mean no. The answer was, it was actually a yes or no question. That was the first indication that something was wrong, and he didn't pick up on it.
Good
so
point,
you,
Peter. Very good.
You think, generally speaking, it was a poorly conducted interview?
It was. That was one of the points of deception, was about the never having arguing, no mental health history. And then later on she talked about him talking about suicide. She was completely deceptive in the area about where the gun was being held. At that point, she drifted into the present tense language. And remember, this is a past tense event. It was in the past. She should be able to recite it going backwards and forwards. It's like a parade going through the eyes. And the past tense verb is something that children age 3 can do. She included another indicator of deception. She included emotions. She was able to describe her emotions while this was happening, but she wasn't asked to. Usually what people will do is while they're going through a trauma, their adrenaline is flowing, the hormones are flowing. They're not thinking of their emotions. They're simply reacting. When someone includes the emotions in the story rather than after the story, it's generally a sign of deception. So I think that she was being deceptive about their relationship, about money, and in particular about holding the gun. Her language, she would not pass a polygraph, that's for sure.
Peter, let me ask you this. I noted listening to those tapes that the volume of her voice was very, very low, very difficult to hear on the tapes. Do you attach any significance to that?
I do, because at several places where it got very low, she put her hands right to her face. In fact, I made on some of my notes there that when she described having 2 beers, right away the hands went right to the face, the voice got lower. We normally say that 3 is a liar's number, where people that are being deceptive will for some reason, cling to the number three and the third floor, and there were three men behind me, except when it comes to alcohol. And they'll say, you know, how many drinks did you have? And they'll come up with two, only two, officer. And this was her area where she was. So the question is, for me, as I went through and there was a number of these indicators of deception, is why does she need to be deceptive about a suicide? She skipped over some periods of time that were very sensitive. She used phrases like, the next thing I know, I'm getting a gun pulled on me by a cop. At that point, the interview should have just really focused upon that. She described trying to find a pulse while he was gasping for air. If someone is gasping for air, why would you need to reach for the neck and then reach for the arm to have a pulse? He's obviously alive still. He's gasping for air. So there are things like that that... in fact, that particular statement reminded me of Casey Anthony's Dead Squirrels Crawled Up My Car, in that order.
Right.
You remember that one, Denny?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Where the dead squirrels, that's why the smell of decomposition was in the car. The same type of response was from Rebecca. So she's not being honest, and the constant interruptions by the investigator were very concerning. The feeding her of language. He would give her answers if she didn't come up with them right away. And that's just and these are 101 things in terms of interviewing. So it was pretty stunning.
Donna,
mm-hmm.
What was your impression of the police investigation of the shooting? Did they seem to be very thorough to you? Did they seem to be doing a good job as far as you knew?
Are you talking about at the scene or with her or what?
The whole thing. Your impression of their performance.
From the get-go, I don't think they did a good job. They didn't collect hardly anything at the scene. They didn't print the gun. There was ashtrays full of cigarettes, and it looked to me like there could have been a party there. There was nobody else. The only people that were interviewed were the people that was there at the time, and then when I would question up there, what about this one or that one? Well, then he would make a little effort. But he kept saying, anybody that's got any information, you tell them to come see me. And I just didn't see anything.
Donna Underwood, did you at any time consult an attorney or hire an attorney on this?
No, we didn't have the money to do that,
okay.
No.
The reason I'm saying that is because even as a private detective or an attorney working for you or somebody working for you, a spokesperson or whatever it may be, the first thing I would want to know is what I made the comment on before. What work did she do for law enforcement, and was this a conflict of interest with the same investigators that are investigating this? Does she work on a regular basis for them, and does she get paid money? So that's a very important thing that needs to come to light. I mean, she said it right on the tape, so that's the first thing I would want to know. What kind of a job does she do? Well, we can't tell you, Mr. Colucci. Oh, yes, you can. You're going to have to tell somebody because, if this lady works for you, you're paying her some kind of money and you're friends with her or deal with her on a regular basis, you can't be handling this case or you shouldn't be handling this case.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we asked, about it. But we were made to feel like we didn't know that we wasn't smart enough to know anything.
Mm.
And I asked him about, before I ever watched the tapes or listened to them, I asked him about what he thought about, her statements. And he says, there was no major differences. Everything was consistent. And then after I watched them and I called him back and I said, how can you say that she's got two completely different stories on how Daniel was shot? One, she's saying he's been over the barrel of the gun and pulled the trigger without speaking. The second one, she's saying they stood up. They were like 6 inches away from each other's face when the gun went off. And I said, that's not consistent. And,
yeah.
He's just telling me all this stuff that they have no problem with anything. And after I talked to Maria, she was saying about how she was struggling with him, fighting with him over that gun. And she says that she was shaking it and shoving it back and forth at him. Then she said, I asked her, so when did she have a hold of that gun before it went off, how long before? And she said, no, she had her hands on the gun when it went off. And I asked her, 3 or 4 times at the very least, when it went off, Maria? And she'd tell me, yes. And then she said, after he fell on his left side, and she kept on. It took her two or three times at least to get him turned over into his back. She picked up the gun, and she put it in the bedroom. Well, the ranger was involved because they said it was a suspicious death because he was laying on top of the gun, and the gun was broke open. And I called the ranger back, and I said, after I talked to Maria, and I didn't even tell him I talked to Maria, and I said, can you tell me how you made the determination that Daniel fell on top of that gun? And he got very upset with me, and he said, are you trying to say we didn't adequately investigate the case? And at that time, I just said, no, sir, I'm not, because I wanted him to still, you know, do something. So I didn't try to make him, you know, mad at me at all. But I'm like, I just wanted an answer, and I knew that Maria had given me a different, completely different answer. So, you know, I was very upset about that.
Vito or Denny, maybe one of you can chime in on this. You know, do you think the police investigate a crime differently dependent on whether or not, you know, the first assessment is suicide or a homicide?
Yeah, I mean, what happens is, unfortunately, when they get what's called tunnel vision and lock into something, it's very difficult to get them off of that, you know, until a captain or lieutenant comes in to say, what do you got? And the detectives say, well, here's what I think. And a good lieutenant or captain will say, well, I don't care what you think. What do we have working on this? You know, these are the type of cases, just I was listening to everybody, where I wish I was still a cop again and sitting across the table from Rebecca and to just, you know, conduct it the proper way and to even a point in here to say, Rebecca, help me out with this. The night after he dies, you take his wedding ring from a previous marriage and his favorite pool sticks and you go to sell them. Any remorse in doing that, Rebecca? Help me out with this so I can understand you a little bit more. Why? Why? Why did you have to do that so quick? See, I want to get those kind of answers from people on these kind of cases. What possessed you to go out the next day and sell some of his property? I don't understand it, Rebecca. Help me with this. I mean, those are the type of – that's the type of an attitude and a direction you have to go on these cases, you see?
And the gun was
supposed
to have been in his right hand.
I'm sorry. There's a point there about the 911 call that was concerning to me. She uses language that we call a temporal lacunae. It means a passage of time. When someone says, and after that, or the next thing you know it, they're skipping over time, and it's usually a reason for it. It's very sensitive. Well, she skips over time right about where the 911 call was being made. So I made a note on Monday with the analysis, and I got in touch with Donna, and she was able to fax me over Maria's statement. And sure enough, she is withholding critical information about the 911 call. She didn't want to make the 911 call. Maria had to argue with her into making that call. Isn't that correct?
Yes. She told her to call 911, and she was saying, no, wait, no, hold on, wait. And then at one time she said, no, she didn't want to open the door because she would let her cat out, and she didn't want him to get out.
So this was evident in the interview itself, too, and that's what is concerning is that the investigator was listening to these jumps of time that she would use and these deceptive-like phrases and not stop and not pause. He went out of her way. Almost the interview sounded the opposite of what Vito just did. He went out of his way to make her comfortable in her answers, and even where she stalled, he coached her into the answers. It's appalling.
Don Underwood.
Yes.
There was a question in the chat room, was Maria cooperative? And I assume from what I'm hearing that she has been cooperative with you.
Yes, she has to us. The first interview, she was, you know, more traumatized than what you would have, you know, and you would think it was normal. She didn't get as much out as I thought she should have. The second interview that they went to her house, she was sick in bed, and I couldn't hear it all. It's just all, every time she answers, there's a big static comes across it, so I can't make it out. So, but I have talked to her twice, and I feel like she's telling me the truth, you know, as far as what actually happened, that she knows. And she says, you know, when she talks about it, she says, you know, that she remembered more as it went along.
Where does the case, where is the case at right now?
As
is
far
it closed? Is this case closed?
Yes.
It is.
And they more or less told us that day that by the time the preliminary, whatever you call it, on the autopsy come, that would be it, you know. And the autopsy showed the angle of the gun left to right. Well, Daniel was supposedly holding the gun in his right hand. He was shot in that soft palate, which is a gag reflex when you do that. And he was in the middle of a sentence, is what Maria said. When the gun went off, she said, and then he was talking, or and it was like he was in the middle of the word what, but he kind of raised his voice on what, like something was happening at the time.
So did the medical examiner agree with the police that this was a suicide?
Yes. The report that he got was that Daniel was depressed, had a history of depression, a history of alcoholism. He was never treated for anything like that. He never had any signs that lately he had a lot of plans. He had plans for the weekend, and, you know, they just went by that. There was bruises on Daniel's body. I looked at the crime scene photos when I could make myself, and I started looking at him, and I'm like, there's bruises on his body, like, you know, like you'd had a hold of his arms and all of his chest. And I questioned him. I called the ME's office, and they had to go pull up the photos of him. And she called me back, and she said, yes, I do agree with you, that there does look like there was bruises on there. And I'm like, well, the detective said there was no history of domestic violence. And I'm like, how can they say that? They didn't even bother reporting these bruises on my son. How can they say that there was no domestic violence and not even put that in their notes?
I have a question. One thing that struck me during the course of this case or reading the different things about this case is that Maria just happened to be, you know, in and out while they're arguing. And, you know, they're arguing and they're struggling over a shotgun, and she's there, and then she pops out of the room, out of the area, and then she pops back. Did she ever give you a reason for why, you know, in the middle of this intense struggle that she, was she trying to get away from it, or
why she wasn't right there?
She
tells me that Rebecca kept telling her over and over to go back in there and call Jimbo, that was her boyfriend, Jimbo, to come back over there or to come over there. Maria said she just kept on and on telling her that. And Maria had, that was going to be her first night of staying there. Daniel was letting her stay because she was in the middle of a divorce, and she was paying him like $25 a week just, you know, to help her out. That was going to be her first night, but she said, but she wasn't planning on going that night. She said Rebecca kept on and on telling her, yeah, come on in and stay this night, because she said she was going to wait till a night or two. She had some other plans, you know. But she said Rebecca was just really insistent on her coming that night.
Good. Donna, what is your relationship now with Rebecca? Do you have any dealings with her? Did she go back with another boyfriend or something?
I don't have any relationship with her, but I know she's been with I don't know how many other guys, and she's been calling several of them her fiancés.
Several of them. Now, what is your goal? Obviously, you think that this was not the suicide as it has been ruled. What would you like to see happen here? Do you want a new investigation? Do you want the death certificate changed? What is it you would like to see happen?
Oh, I want it all. I believe that Daniel deserves a new investigation, and not by the ones that did it the first time.
Now, have you approached the police yet regarding? Do you intend to approach them and confront them, or not confront? Maybe that's a poor word, and discuss with them the information that Maria has given you, which seems to contradict the majority of what Rebecca stated.
I plan on it sooner or later, yes. I plan on asking for an inquest or whatever I have to get it reopened. They were going to give her a polygraph, and she agreed to it, and then she said she talked to her lawyers and decided she wasn't going to take one, but she told everybody she took it and passed it.
Very interesting. Hey, we're going to need to wrap this segment up. Denny or Vito, do you have any last questions before we wrap this up and go on to the next segment?
Well, just that I'd like, Denny, maybe that you to stay in touch with Donna there. And I know it's a closed case right now, but, you know, maybe after we air it tonight and what we're doing here, maybe we could kind of point this in some kind of direction, Denny, you know?
That's what I'm hoping. Don Underwood, please, let's keep in touch on this and let us know, because we will certainly update the case here on the show. And if we can assist you in any way, we'd be happy to do that. And I know Peter.
I do appreciate that. I want to say one more thing, that she did steal his laptop and his cell phone, and she wiped his cell phone completely clean of his contact numbers. She took stuff off the laptop, and, you know, this was just right after it happened. That's when she went and stole that.
Well, Donna, the best of luck, and please keep us informed, okay?
All right, I will.
And I want to thank Donna Underwood for being on our show tonight, and Peter Hyatt, crime lawyer consultant, thank you for, once again, being with us. Always great to have you on.
Thank you.
I think you're going to introduce the next segment.
Sure. I'd like to start off by saying I want our listeners to really pay attention to this case. It's the biggest case in the country right now going on. One part of the trial ended today. And the last several weeks, I've been involved in many TV shows about this, Joy Behar, Fox News, numerous shows over the last several weeks. I'm talking about the Cheshire murder case, Cheshire, Connecticut, of the Pettit family. The only one alive is Dr. William Pettit, that was really left for dead. The 11-year-old daughter, Michaela, is dead. 17-year-old daughter, Haley, is dead. And the mother-slash-wife, Jennifer Hawk Pettit, is dead. I've been involved in police work or private detective work since the late 1960s. And in my opinion, this is the most horrible case that I've ever seen in my life. Now, I know when I said that on Joy Behar's show, she said, well, what about the Manson murders? And I said, well, you know, we're talking about things all on the same level, okay? But the details of this case, these two individuals followed this family home from a supermarket. They attacked the father, Dr. Pettit. They beat him so bad. I mean, when they first showed his pictures of his stitches, it went one side of his head all the way around the other, left him for dead. They sexually assault the women in the household, including the little 11-year-old Michaela. Then they proceed to take sexual pictures of their private parts of these women after they sexually assaulted them, and they're tied to the bedposts. They pour gasoline on their bodies and set them on fire while they are alive and functioning. Unbelievable case, and it has outraged the entire country. Every news channel, every news show is featuring this. I truthfully have never seen a more vicious case in my life, and we're not here to compare this case against that case. There's so many horrible ones. But it has struck a chord with me, having four daughters, I tell you that much. It's absolutely a horrible, horrible case that has gone on. And not only that, they took a poll of a lot of people on the street, let's say in Connecticut, New York, different areas, and they asked them what they felt about the death penalty. And numerous people that said, I am totally against the death penalty, but these guys should get the death penalty. First time I've ever heard people talk like that. These are people that protest against the death penalty that has said, but, you know, I think these guys should get it. So that's the case we're going to discuss now. And Donna Pendergast, you're a prosecutor, and I know you see the horrible of horrible, just like I have and Denny has. What do you think about this case with the verdict today now on Stephen Hayes? He was found guilty very quickly. I said on the TV shows this would be a record deliberation with this guy, and it was. They found him guilty on 16 of 17 counts today.
Vito, I got to tell you, like you said, I've been a prosecutor nearly 24 years, and I've seen, or I thought I had seen, the worst of the worst. I prosecuted Colonel Eugene Watts, who is thought to be the most prolific serial murderer in the history of the United States. You know, terrible case where I had to sift through you know, just volumes and boxes of papers, murder after murder of, you know, young dynamic woman. But this case shakes me to the core, unlike any others. And you know, I've had a few in my career that you never shake. You know, two 12-year-old girls that snuck out of the house in the middle of the night and met up with two, no other word than monster can be used, but two monsters in the park who sexually assaulted them and, you know, killed them in a brutal, horrific manner. Like you said, we've all seen terrible, terrible things, but there is something about this case that put me over the edge. And when I say put me over the edge, what I mean is I have always, despite, you know, what I've seen in my life, been on the fence regarding the death penalty. But I have to say, after reading the facts in this case, well, hearing about it 3 years ago, and then, you know, more recently reading, you know, just the horrific facts, and, you know, what you described is only the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
Like, for the first time in my life, unequivocally, I can say there is no other remedy but the death penalty for these two individuals. I mean, they sexually assaulted an 11-year-old girl. They poured gasoline on her. I mean, they sexually assaulted her mother. How Dr. Pettit has the strength to go on, I don't know, but, you know, I've admired him from afar. And I think he summed it up after the verdict today. He said, you know, I try to do the best I can, you know, when your family is, you know, meets up with evil, you know, you do the best that you can. But,
yeah,
good Lord,
and, you know, I want our listeners to understand, we're talking about Donna, a prosecutor for many years, myself, a narcotics cop and a private detective, and Denny Griffith, who has seen it all as an investigator for New York State and everything else, and the three of us, folks, are blown away on this one, okay? We are totally blown away on this one. This has captured the entire country. There is rage across the country because of this case. Denny, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, Vito, I certainly am right in step with you and Donna on this. And you were mentioning about some polling and what people on the streets thought in Connecticut. Well, I've talked to quite a few people here locally where I am in central New York right now, and also people I know on the Internet through emails and so on. And many of the people I've talked with are not exactly, well, let me say they're a little soft on crime, I think. I'll put it that way. And right as you were saying, even these people who almost floored me, but they are so enraged over what's happened here that they're demanding that these people be executed. So it certainly, I haven't heard many, in fact, I haven't heard of any so far people who think this was a wrong thing or that the death penalty should be off the table. And I do want to add, we just posted a new poll tonight on the CrimeWire website about this case, and it's my understanding was that the defense, I believe for both defendants, or at least for Hayes, offered a guilty plea in return for a life sentence, in which they wanted to avoid the death penalty possibility, and that the prosecutors rejected that offer and wanted to go with a trial and the death penalty, and to seek the death penalty if convicted. And we put a poll up. There's only two answers to it. One is that under the circumstances, due to the viciousness of this, the murders, that the actions of the prosecutors was appropriate and justified. And the second answer is their decision to reject the guilty plea was inappropriate, that they should have grabbed, you know, the bird in the hand and not put the state to the expense of two trials. So anybody, if you get a chance, step our website, we'd love to know what you think about the prosecutors and their attitude and how they approached this case. And,
yeah,
of course,
Donna,
we have one guilty verdict.
Isn't it amazing, okay, Donna, how the prosecutors said on this one, we don't care about anything you want to say to us. We don't want your information. We don't care if you know who captured the Lindbergh baby. We don't want nothing. We're going all the way on this. So we're not helping you guys in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I might add, too, you know, a case like this, it's like as a prosecutor, you know, a bird in the hand is always better than a trial because you never know what a jury is going to do with the trial. That being said, in a case as clear-cut as this, they caught them at the scene. Hayes gave a confession of sorts, of course, very self-serving. But, you know, a life sentence is not good enough. And I might add that Dr. Pettit has become quite the advocate for the death penalty, and he was totally on board. You know, and that's the same thing we do, you know, in my office and most prosecutors' offices around the country. You know, what the victim has to say weighs very heavily in what the prosecutor is going to do. But, you know, as a general rule, if somebody offers to plead straight up to first-degree murder, as a prosecutor, you grab it. Now, you know, no matter how good the case is, because,
right,
as you said, it's a bird in the hand. But in a case like this, it's just not good enough. And frankly, the death penalty isn't good enough. You know, there's no true justice in a case like this. You know, there's only justice as best we can do it under the most terrific of circumstances.
That's a good point, Donna. You know, that's a very good point. There is no justice on this case. Many of these other murder cases, there is in some kind of a way. This is kind of going through the motions and giving them what they deserve. But there's no way you can even capture any bit of justice out of this.
We've been joined. I'm sorry.
What?
I was just going to say we've been joined by our consultant from Citizens Against Homicide, Gene Cervantes. And Gene, now like the rest of us, we've all seen our share, heard our share of horror stories about what one person can do to another. And you've had a lot of experience in that too for your with your work. How does this case stack up against some of the ones you've been exposed to?
Well, Denny, what I my experience is in the 30 years with the Department of Corrections in the classification system, and part of that is to review every inmate who comes into a program prison and look at them and in terms of their commitment offense, and I've reviewed some cases that, you know, it's just unimaginable that a human being could do what they've done to other human beings. Well, that being said, I, like Vito said, we're not here to compare case to case and this case against that case. What I'd like to say is I was approached. It was just the opposite of what you guys did when you asked in a survey or asked friends what they thought. I was approached, and they asked, what do you think of this case? I said, what case? Well, you know, the one back in Connecticut. And I said, oh, my God. Yeah. And it turned out that they knew more about it than me. I said, well, they definitely deserved the death penalty, both of them. And they said, well, it's a good thing it's in Connecticut because California is releasing life, you know, prisoners with murder convictions, maybe not as heinous as the the crime that was committed by these two animals. But it's an unprecedented number of parole grants by the parole board. And the judges are getting involved because the convicts write a writ of habeas corpus, and the judges literally order the Board of Prison Terms to release these guys unless they could find some reasonable evidence to support retention. And it's going to spread throughout the United States if we don't get a handle on it. And, you know, I encourage all advocacy groups out there to do something, campaign against judges getting involved, or better yet, implement the death penalty when you get a conviction. I mean, California is got a terrible track record. But
You know, Gene, what I was my thought is this. I know the death penalty obviously can be very heated advocates on both sides of it. But my position, I know that sometimes when you have people of the caliber of these two individuals we're talking about in Connecticut, And if you remember, it was about a month or so ago, those two guys, both convicted killers, escaped in Arizona. They were not on death row, okay, but they were convicted killers. They escaped and bumped off, or at least one of them bumped off a couple of more people.
Right.
And my belief is that as long as you have people that are capable of the violence that guys like the guys from Arizona and these two characters in Connecticut and others demonstrate, as long as they're drawing breath, they're a danger to someone. Now, it could be fellow inmates. And I know you say, well, who cares, you know, inmate against inmate, who cares what happens? Well, okay. But you also have prison staff. And I know a while back, well, several years ago in New York State, a prison guard was killed by a guy who was doing three life sentences without parole. It was having a female guard. He got her, and they only identified him as the killer because he bit one of her breasts off, and they were able to match up the bite marks. But this guy had nothing more they could do to him. He was already doing three life sentences without parole. He could kill as many guards or inmates as he wanted to, and that was just the way it was. Nothing more serious was going to happen to him. And now you got these two guys, and I agree with Donna that these guys, a life sentence would not have been sufficient for people like these. My only concern now is that they'll outlive Dr. Pettit, because there will be, you know, the dreaded appeals process for 20 or 30 years. And I'm exaggerating a little bit probably, but probably for many years. And these guys will outlive maybe Dr. Pettit himself. And that's, I think that is a shame if that works out.
Well, and I agree.
Danny, if I may, go on.
Well, in California, it is 20 to 25 year appeal process. But anyway, that being said, the attitude that you just described is common. It's a common attitude among life prisoners. They think, I got nothing to lose. What are you going to do to me? Put me in secure housing, you know, what we call SHU. And, okay, so what? I'll go up there with the homeboys. I don't know what the answer is.
Hey, Danny, if I may,
sure.
For all the listeners who don't know all the details of this case, I just want to give just a thumbnail sketch so they really understand what we're talking about here.
Sure.
We're talking about two guys. Mr. Hayes was convicted today, and his co-defendant, who will be going to trial shortly, who in advance of this heinous crime are talking about it and texting. And, in fact, Mr. Hayes texted, "I'm chomping at the bit to start." And they text each other, and one says, laughing out loud, about the thought of it. Let's just, for the listeners who don't know, let me just tell you what happened. These two individual crackheads, one who later, Mr. Hayes, the one who was convicted today, who later said, the reason I did this is because my life sucked, they come up on this house that they had stalked and targeted beforehand. Dr. Hayes is asleep on a couch. They come in, beat the living heck out of him, and tie him to a pole in the basement. They then go upstairs and tie two little girls, well, one 11 years old and one 17 years old, to their beds. They take Dr. Pettit's wife to a bank where she withdraws $15,000 under the misplaced belief that her family will be safe if she just gives them that money. While Mr. Hayes was taking Dr. Pettit's wife, Jennifer Pettit, to the bank, his partner, Mr. Komisarjewski, rapes an 11-year-old girl. When Mrs. Pettit arrives back at the house with the money and Mr. Hayes, to square up the deal, Mr. Komisarjewski, who has just raped an 11-year-old, tells Mr. Hayes, well, now you got to rape the wife to square things up. So Mrs. Pettit is raped, and then the 11-year-old girl has gasoline poured on her, and they start the house on fire, and the house burns down. Dr. Pettit managed to, on an adrenaline rush, struggle out of that house and crawl and roll over to his neighbor's house. The neighbor didn't even recognize him. He was beaten so badly. I mean, this is the, you know, the very low details of what we're talking about here. So when we talk the death penalty, I mean, that is a fact scenario that it's almost too large to get your arms around.
And I think that's why
it has swayed a lot of people.
And don't forget,
you're not
Donna,
even talking about the pain and suffering, the emotional and psychological effect it had on the wife, Ms. Pettit. We have a poor excuse of an appeal process in California where they're saying, oh, you can't put this guy to death because he may feel pain. Duh.
Yeah, right.
What about the pain?
Can you imagine
the victim?
He did this because his life sucked? I mean, I mean, you and I and everybody listening, we can't even comprehend that kind of, you know, just callous type of statement that shows an absolute disregard for
Donna, it's amazing, Donna, that you and I can say that after everything we've worked and seen, that we're sitting here saying we can't comprehend it. And like one of the ladies
around it. I start shaking when I think about the case.
One of the ladies on the blog said the same thing that numerous women have said to me over the last 2 weeks. Imagine the terror that those three, well, couple of young girls and a mother went through. The terror. I think that sums up the word. Terror is an amazing word. Okay, that's all this was. And don't forget, Donna, too, they have the nerve to take the pictures, the sexual pictures, too, after they have sex. Okay,
oh, yeah.
I mean, unbelievable. I mean, it's just one part of this crazy, crazy thing that they did. I mean, you know, your child is tied to a bedpost, totally awake, not beaten or anything, had been sexually assaulted, which is absolutely horrible. But now knowing that the gasoline's being poured in them, and here comes the match. Wow, that is incredible. Unbelievable.
And
I mean,
Haley, the 17-year-old, managed to break her bones, and she made it to the top of the steps where, you know, she collapsed, and, you know, signs on her body show that, you know, she was burnt quite badly, and that's probably what killed her. I mean, it's just, like I said, I mean, there's no other words than it's hard to get your arms around. I mean, it's so horrific. It's just, Dr. Pettit said it's evil. They confronted evil. And, I mean, I tell my juries often, you know, there is no explanation for evil, just recognition of what it is.
Yeah, I said on one of the shows that the only other case that I could think of that rivals this is the Truman Capote book, In Cold Blood, that was a true story of the Clutter family back in the 1950s in Kansas, where each one of the family, children and the parents, were brutally murdered. But again, it's like comparing one thing to the other. This case has totally annihilated me, I tell you. It's just incredible.
You know, I've got to think, and I'll get everybody's opinion, but I'm going to assume that when they start the penalty phase or do the penalty phase starting on the 18th, this will end up in a death sentence. I'd be very surprised if it if there was any other result. Donna, as a prosecutor, What do you think? Do you think this is the type of thing? Are there enough grounds for different appeals here that this could be one of these drag on for 20 or 25 year deals, or do you see it more cut and dried than that?
Well, you know, Michigan doesn't have the death penalty, so even though I see, you know, even in all the murder convictions I've had, an appeal upon appeal. I mean, they get their appeal to the Court of Appeals, and then into the Supreme Court, and then under Michigan court rules, and I'm just talking about Michigan right now, they have a right to go back to the trial court for what's called a 6500 motion, and then if the judge denies that, and that's basically saying I didn't have a fair trial for whatever constitutional reason, and then they appeal to the Court of Appeals, you know, if they deny the 6500 motion, and then ultimately it goes up to the federal court for habeas corpus. And, you know, that takes a long time, but we're not talking 25 years. But we don't have a death penalty here. And,
right.
You know, I do have enough familiarity with death penalty states to understand it takes years upon years. But I got to tell you, in this case, I have always believed that there is a what I call bad man factor. And in a case like this, that is so clear-cut. I mean, for gosh sakes, they're caught red-handed at the scene. You have confessions of sorts. The physical evidence is overwhelming. The surveillance at the bank, the tape, you know, Mr. Hayes. If there's any way to, you know, for the courts to cut through the rigmarole, this is the case where it's going to happen. Will it take a long time? No question about it. But do I think that long time is going to be 25 years? I don't think so. And I guess before we ever get there, should I say, do I think there's going to be a, you know, an adjudication of death penalty? Boy, if it doesn't come down in this case, I don't know when it would come down.
You know, that brings up an interesting point. Well, it may not be interesting, but I like some opinions on it. Previously, I don't remember just how long ago, but when this case was getting ready to go to trial, I read or heard or something somewhere that the police actions that day were being questioned or challenged, and that they supposedly, I guess that when they took the Mrs. Pettit to the bank to make this $15,000 withdrawal, she told the clerk or the teller or whatever what was going on. The police were called, and there was some allegation that they were actually surveilling the house, the residence, or parked outside of it or something. But they didn't want to do anything right away. They weren't sure what they had. They weren't sure if there was a hostage situation or exactly
I can
what
answer
was
that.
Going on.
Denny, I can answer that before we run out of time. What had happened there, Denny, was the captain did call for the SWAT team, just like they would in any hostage situation. Now, like I said on television, the hostage team is not waiting at headquarters all the time. There's guys off duties. There's guys that live in other towns. They're assembling themselves to get there. And I also said on television, never does a SWAT team, whether it's a bank, a school, or anything, just get to the place and run in. They have to, you know, they were told this is a hostage situation, so they have to follow the right protocol. A lot of flack has been given. Well, they're parked outside, and they're not, you know, they came in unmarked cars. They kept all the marked squad cars far, far away. They called for the SWAT team. You know, they did the right procedures. Everybody thought they were going to kick down the door and run in retrospect, now that we know what happened. But no, it's not the proper thing to do. But let me say two other things before we run out of time. Number one, there's a very good chance, and I'm not saying I hope this, but it's just the way, you know, you reap what you sow in life. There's a very good chance that the individuals would probably, and I hate to say it, be killed in jail. Okay, you know, there's a good chance of that happening, and no one would care in the jail, whether it's a guard or the prisoner or whatever. That's number one. I forgot what number two was going to be, but you know, there's a lot of things on here that it may not even get that 20-year part. You know, Denny.
Yeah.
And you know, I have to say, it's great to, you know, guess in retrospect what the police should have done or that they should have acted faster. But, you know, I don't think anybody can fault the police for adhering to a protocol. You know, they didn't know what they had. They knew they had a hostage situation, but there are certain, you know, cautions or precautions that have to be taken in a hostage situation. And, you know, the police were mobilizing. They were acting. Granted, you know, everybody today says, God, why couldn't have it been 15 minutes earlier? But, you know, there's precautions they have to take for their own safety. So Monday morning quarterbacking, you know, that's well and fine. But the truth is, I don't think the police can be faulted here.
But, you know, let's look at it the other way, because that's what I thought when I first heard that was being kicked around in some places about the police action or lack of action. And I said, you know, now that we know, yeah, with 2020 hindsight, what the situation was, sure. But suppose two officers had arrived on the scene in response to the initial call and went barging in the house, and these guys were in the process of leaving. They were just going to tie the victims up, you know, until they could get away or whatever. And they got startled when the cops burst through the door and they executed two or three of them. Then what would they be saying about the police? I mean, it's a very tough situation, but
sure.
I think it was, you know, one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't things. And probably what they did undoubtedly was according to procedure and actually made sense, although knowing what we know now, it's frustrating.
Sure. All right, well, guys, we're running out of time here. And once again, Jean Cervantes, thank you for calling in and chiming in with us. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Delilah Jones of our Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, October 19th, 2010. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com or hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show at www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard. When there is nowhere else to turn, visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Good night and God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Donna Pendergast, and Peter Hyatt tonight. Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.